All right, there we go.
So I must say that your credential is quite impressive, and it doesn't tell even half of the story because I've followed your work and I've known your work for some time, intimately, not just from a distance. So it's a real delight for my co-host Emeka and I to have you as our guest. So please welcome.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you so
Okay,
much. I'm
so
humbled.
let's. Oh, it's our delight. So let me ask the first question. I think that one of the most important developments, social and political, in Nigeria in recent years was the 2020 NSAS movement in the country. I want you to speak sort of broadly about the connection, sort of from your vantage point as somebody who has worked and labored in the area of police reform. How did that moment illuminate the work that you've devoted several decades doing in this area?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. The eruption of that NSAS, I would call it, it was like a revolt, a people's revolt, led by the youth. For me, it was not unexpected. What was I wasn't surprised. What was a surprise to me was that it came so late. Because over time, myself, my organization, and other colleagues who have been working in the area of police reform had been, documenting, denouncing, and exposing human rights violations in the context of law enforcement. And the unit that was involved in the most egregious violations, the now defunct SARS, was not alone. It's just that SARS became it became the metaphor, for police abuse, police violence in Nigeria. There were other units like, the unit led by the now disgraced Abba Kyari, whose atrocities, by the way, had been documented. For me, there was nothing new that the US government found and said about Abba Kyari that we had not said. I personally engaged him, and in many cases that I engaged him on, there were cases where he quietly returned money that his operatives extorted from people. So there was nothing for me. It wasn't a, so it was the failure by the authorities to address, widespread human rights violations by the police. Of course, we have a lot of external oversight agencies, a lot of agencies that have oversight mandates. You have the Police Service Commission, which is the statutory agency that has the mandate to oversight the police. It didn't have the capacity to do that. We had the National Human Rights Commission, which had the powers under its establishment law to also pay visits to places of detention, but it wasn't carrying out those, So the media at some point got tired of reporting violations, egregious violations. So nobody did anything. Government didn't do anything until it got to a stage that the youth could no longer take it. The youth, by the way, were the main victims, main targets of predatory police officers who engage in all manner of, vicious abuse, corruption, extortion. Police would arrest people, seize their money, seize their property, and convert them. They were not taking these things to present as exhibit. They were simply diverting them and stealing them. They would kill people and take over their property. So we have a lot of, in fact, what NSAS represented for me, it was like a validation of the one of the statements in the preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which said that if men are not to if men are not to be forced to take recourse to rebellion, you know, against human rights, against injustice, you know, that human rights must be protected by the rule of law, you know. So what happened was that it got to a stage where Nigerian citizens, particularly the youths who were the main targets, could no longer take it. And if you look at the particular incident that was the immediate trigger, you know, police officers arrest young people driving in a vehicle. Young people became targets. If they see you with a laptop or a phone that looks expensive, you automatically labeled advanced fee fraudster, you know, they call it Yahoo. Mm-hmm. And they will carry out, you know, invasive search on people, you know, force them to, you know, the POS or ATM machine and you know, take their secret PIN and force them to transfer money. So for me, it was the failure to hold perpetrators of these egregious violations to account that created the atmosphere of impunity that made it possible for police officers who, rather than protect, serve and protect the people, became predators. So, I mean, it's a long story, but I mean, this just in a summary is, you know, is what I can say. Mm-hmm. Failure to hold to account those who took laws, you know, who were acting above the law. The police became mm-hmm. a law unto themselves rather than being law enforcement agents. They were breaking law and they were enjoying impunity because nobody was doing anything about it.
Hmm. Thank you very much. This is it's you brought in so much into this opening response that in a sense is going to take the rest of the of our conversation to unpack some of the issues that you raised. But one of the immediate issues that I'd like to get to is, okay, so the youth finally erupted in an act of rebellion, as you aptly said, in 2020 October. And that rebellion, we all know how it ended with the government coming down hard in what was seen as an excessive application of force to end that rebellion. So the question that I have for you is, has anything of significance, has there been any significant change in your view in policing and in the institution of the police and in the way that the police carry out their operations since that uprising in 2020 by the youth? And if there has been any significant change, in what areas?
Okay, it would be important to point out that the NSAS uprising happened in October 2020, mm-hmm. and this was about a month after the Police Act came into force. Mm-hmm. You know, the Nigerian police continued to be governed with a colonial legislation.
That's the first question that I need to pose before I say what has changed. Can you describe the colonial legislation that used to govern the Nigerian police force, and then bring us up to speed, or bring us and our listeners up to speed about the reforms that were embodied in the 2020 Police Act?
Okay, so the Colonial Police Act that was eventually reviewed in 2020, in September 2020, about a month before the eruption of the NSAS protest, was enacted by the colonial authorities in 1943, which meant that it predated the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Nigeria at independence inherited the institutions and culture of the colonial police.
So the Declaration of Human Rights came out when?
1948.
Yeah, good. So by a year. It predated it by a year.
So yeah. the Colonial Police Act was made in 1943. And it never changed until through the post-colonial era, through the nearly 16 unbroken years of military dictatorship in Nigeria, and more than 20 years after the eventual return to elective politics. And I choose my words carefully because people talk about democracy. I don't think that Nigeria has attained democracy. Period after 1999 up to 2020, the same colonial act continued to govern policing. And there had been efforts that started as far back as 2004 to review that colonial act. But we continued, and civil society, you know, in Nigeria, we even came up with, we had to do a review. We got, you know, experts to do an audit on all the laws, you know, and come up with a draft bill that will repeal, you know. But of course, successive parliaments would find a reason to reject it. So it was a long drawn campaign, you know, advocacy to get this colonial law, you know, reviewed in a comprehensive manner. So there was reluctance, there was resistance by government until eventually September 2020. When we were able to get the parliament to repeal the colonial act and, you know, enact this new act, which, contains a lot of innovative provisions.
Yes, and
because the first thing we thought needed to be done was to redefine the vision and operational mission, the philosophical, you know, mission of the police. Because the police that we had was a police set up by the colonial authorities to subjugate the local community. It was a police of conquest, you know, a police of suppression. So that was the vision of policing. So we needed to start by changing the vision and the mission of, and that is why if you look at the Police Act, it starts by talking about the need for a police in a democracy, you know, that prioritizes respect for human rights, partnership, community policing, you know, and all that, partnership with the community, you know, accountability and transparency. So these are the features that, you know, the objectives that this new act was, you know, set out to achieve, rather than, because the colonial act was all about enforcement of law enforcement, fighting crime and all that. There was nothing about, you know, human rights, you know, partnership with the community, transparency, accountability, because the police has always been, you know, it has never really seen itself as a police of the people, accountable to the people. It has always been accountable only to the president. And that is why we always say that Nigeria is the only country in the world where you find that both policy and operational control of the police are centralized in the hands of the president. And part of the reforms we wanted to achieve was to reform the procedure for the appointment of the Inspector General of Police, because it helps to determine the policing philosophy, you know, whether the police is accountable to the president or to the law and to the people through elected representatives.
Can you hear me?
You know, the parliament being reluctant
to do any fundamental
change in that regard. So you still find that.
Could you hear me? Okay, there was a short break in what you were saying. Oh boy, did we lose him?
Yeah, people probably log back in. Networks in Nigeria.
Oh boy, yeah.
Unless you are using the new Elon Musk's network works in Nigeria. That's
starting. Oh, it works.
Yeah, it started working. July. It started working, I think, in February or January.
Yeah.
Yeah, using that. That's the best thing to use. Every other thing is very dodgy.
Okay.
So sorry about that.
It's all right. You know, we know our country, don't we? Yeah. Okay. So you are making a very important point about the centralization. The police affairs are centralized in the president, and that part of the so if you can go back to that point that you were making around that issue.
Yeah, so I was trying to highlight some of the challenges we had in the course of trying to change this colonial act. We thought that it was important to insulate the police from political control, which has always been a major obstacle to, professionalism, and effectiveness. Because when you find that the police feeling that they are accountable only to the president and not to the law or even to the people through elected representatives, it becomes a challenge. And we wanted to encourage the president then to support a reform that will transfer operational control to the Inspector General of Police and to allow for, a competitive, transparent, and merit-driven process of appointment of the Chief of Police, the Inspector General of Police, But this hasn't happened. The much we could get, actually, was to have the Police Act, restate that the president has to seek the advice of the police council, which is a constitutional body, before he can appoint the inspector general of police. But what we find in practice is that the president continues to appoint and fire the inspector general of police without reference to the police council. So we have always accused the president of being lawless, not respecting the constitution, and not respecting the police. So I was talking about the innovations in the new Police Act, and I've talked about the preamble, which talks about the need to change the vision of policing, and bring it in line with the principles of policing in a democracy, the concept of democratic policing, and then. We also had provisions such as the one providing secured tenure, specified tenure of 4 years for the Inspector General of Police. Prior to this, under the old act, there was no tenure. It was left at the,
discretion of the president.
So an appointed Inspector General of Police doesn't know when he will be fired. So there was really no time to do long-term visioning. So we make sure that there is a provision for 4-year time. But even at that, as I said, both the former president and the current one as well, who has just made an appointment, didn't comply with that provision, because it requires that only an officer, and the law says it has to be an officer not below the rank of an assistant inspector general of police, who has up to 4 years left in office, left in service. Yeah, but this is not being followed. So the idea of that provision appeared not to be, seems to be defeated, And then we have provisions on trying to. Providing safeguards, procedural safeguards for the exercise of police powers, you know, prohibition of torture, and, you know, safeguards such as, you know, informing a person being arrested of the reason for the arrest, mandating the Inspector General of Police to provide legal access, legal support to people in police custody, you know, and then such other provisions like, you know, prohibiting gender discrimination, which was prominent in the old act, and then also making provisions for funding, you know, funding, you know, police funding, you know, there was no such provision, and so on and so forth. A lot of such, you know, innovative provisions, which we felt would bring the police in line, bring police operations in line with policing in a democracy. So, but in spite of all the provisions, you find that the president, who ought to lead by example, by acting in accordance with laws and the statutes, you know, established institutions, hardly, you know, comply with these laws. So you find a situation where the Inspector General of Police will go to the Southeast and tell the police that they should go after IPOP and kill them and don't bother about complaints about human rights violation. After all, the report will come to his table. And this is in contradiction with the provisions under the act that provides for rules of engagement, you know. So, and the president doesn't seem to be concerned about calling the IG to order each time he goes against the law, because he himself as well goes against the law. So because there is no leadership at the political level, and because the police is still under, you know, the influence of the president, nothing happens, you know, it's still business as usual.
Yes. So would you say then that the NSAS movement, had any effect, moved the clock in any significant way in terms of the work and the vision that you had for police reforms?
So you know that the NSAS protest was sustained for nearly 1 week. This was a protest that was triggered by revolt against police brutality. And ironically, the same protest was, you know, violently quelled, you know, crushed with violence, with some, you know, in brutality. Now, but of course, before that happened, the government had made some, or appeared to have made some concessions. Of course, I had the IG then, the Inspector General of Police at the time, conceding that the people have a right to protest and that their demands have been noted, promises were made that they were going to investigate. First of all, they had to disband that particular unit, the SARS, and then promised that they were going to investigate the allegations of human rights violations. And government went ahead to set up judicial panels of inquiry across the states for victims to bring their complaints. These panels sat across the states. A lot of thousands of victims sent in, you know, petitions and complaints, apart from in Lagos, where a few victims got some token in terms of monetary compensation. In the main, there wasn't much in terms of redress or justice for the victims. So it was more like those panels of inquiry were meant to, it was a subterfuge used to, you know, to calm, you know, public nerves. And when people had forgotten about it, everything went. Within a year after NSAS, we began to record similar violations, killings, arbitrary detention, torture, extortion. So, you know, the only thing that changed then was that the ruthlessness with which the government, you know, quelled that peaceful protest led to a nationwide, you know, violence that targeted police stations.
Mm.
So it made it possible for, I mean, a lot of police stations were attacked and burnt. Police, you know, police officers could no longer move around in uniform because they became easy targets.
And this happened. Did this happen nationwide, or was it mostly in the southeastern part of Nigeria?
Well, it was more pronounced in the southeast, but we recorded similar attacks in the southwest. You know, some police stations were as well attacked and burnt, you know, in the aftermath of the quelling of that peaceful NSAS, you know, protest. You know, so the people government referred to as hoodlums, you know, took over. And I quarrel with that because it is also the policies of government that give rise to people you call hoodlums. Because if you provide jobs for young people, they're not going to take to crime, you know. So they were the ones, and a lot of them were people who found opportunity to revenge against what the police had either done to them or their relatives, you know. So so what that the effect that had was to, particularly in the southeast, you could not call, you know, make a report to the police from any community and they'll go, because they were already, you know, they were already living in fear. They could no longer. And when you recall that the police headquarters in Imo State, or where Imo State was attacked on the same day that the Imo prisons was also attacked. And these are state institutions that are located very close to the government house. They were attacked for hours without any resistance. You know. So these were some of the aftermaths of the way government responded to the NSAS. So all the promises they made to, you know, implement reforms, implement the police act, they even promised to implement the police act to make sure that these violations don't happen again, and that the officers who are found to be responsible will be brought to account. Nothing has happened. I don't know any police officer that has been, you know, charged for human rights violation. I don't know how many of the victims who appeared before any of the panels in any of the states that received any compensation, except, like I said, very few in Lagos were given between 2 million. I don't think that it was more than 5 million, you know, at the most. And there were just few people. And of course, when the report of that panel was released, the government turned it into deliberately instigated a controversy around it, you know, that put it nothing more happened. Government could not implement anything. So as we speak, I'm sure you have heard about the allegations coming from Anambra where police officers have been accused of organ harvesting.
Yes.
So these were the kind of things that.
Because I was going to actually ask about that. That for a lot of Nigerians, the police represent a criminal entity. It's as if the business of the police is the enterprise of the police is criminality. And so people are hardly surprised when they hear such things. But is there from your organization or from some other organization, is there any legitimacy to those reports that the police engage in organ harvesting and sales?
Okay, so before this particular case that in Anambra became public, in the course of the NSAS protest, I spoke to a lot of media, you know, people locally and internationally. I was granting interviews we also embarked on a fact-finding mission to the Southeast to speak with victims of SARS. The idea was to document evidence that will help some of the victims find justice at the tribunals. Now, virtually every victim that I interviewed who had been detained at the notorious Okoso SARS, of course, we know about the Okoso SARS.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah. Made suggestions about the likelihood of some of the people being killed, you know, having their organs harvested. They painted images of certain strange people who come around each time people are taken behind the cell and executed. Someone comes, you know. Every victim we interviewed made that, because we had to put that question directly. Have you witnessed? They said they always talk about how police officers will come to a cell and call out some people and take them to the back of the cell and execute them. And then what happens to their dead bodies? Nobody knows. And then certain people that come, whose mission are unknown. Now, we know also that the SARS used to also sell dead bodies to some university teaching hospitals. You know, they take these bodies to them and they pay them. What they use them for is what we do not know.
That's documented. It is documented.
The investigation we did is documented, and I'm going to share the report with you. We spoke with a lot of victims who talked about how they will take these bodies to teaching hospitals and then sell them to them. What they use them for is what we do not know. Now, in the case of Anambra, the stories have been told about a place behind this Okoso SARS, where they usually take people to and execute them. Nobody else is allowed to go there. You know, so there have been many cases of people disappearing.
Are there photographs of that facility?
Of Okoso SARS?
Yes. The place where they would take people for execution.
This is like a bush behind the station. And yes, we have called for investigation for detectives to go and find out what's going on there. And when this allegation about the recent one happened, that location also came
up.
You know, came up again. And the police, the Inspector General of Police had said he ordered investigation. That investigation was supposed to last not more than 3 months. It's over 6 months. I had spoken with the officer directly investigating that incident. He told me that the investigation is still ongoing.
After six months?
Yes, investigation is still ongoing. And by the way, the person, the whistleblower who exposed this, because he was working with them until they fell out. So what he did was to expose them to get back at them. Was arrested and detained. And the court, and we were asking them to charge this man to court. And they were reluctant because they are afraid that the young man will reveal things that they don't want people to know. But of course, we are getting information about what's going on. So the Nigerian police is a rogue entity. There is nothing beyond them. There is nothing beyond them. Because,
yes,
like I told you, I've tried to find out from the police, where is the report of this investigation? The first PRO said they had handed over the report to his IG. And when I asked the investigator, he said what was handed over to the IG was a preliminary report, and that the investigation is still ongoing. And the idea is that the investigation will keep ongoing until people
forget.
So there is something they don't want us to know. And I have every good reason to believe that allegation is true. Otherwise, they should prove the whistleblower, no. Wrong. Yes. And by the way, they have removed the particular officer who took over. By the way, the place called Okoso SARS is now run by a certain rapid response squad. The man who is the commander was the last officer in charge of when it was SARS. They have removed him. We don't know where they have taken him to. We have been informed that some senior police officers are involved because they were benefiting from profiting from this criminality going on. They don't want to release the reports. And so when things like this happen after NSAS, I don't think it's difficult for anybody to answer the question, has there been any change?
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. nothing has changed.
Yes. Wow. So I'm going to ask one more question. Emeka, thanks for being so patient. I know you are roaring to get in. But let me put in one more question before I turn it over to my co-host. And for me, this is a fundamental question. So you have done really outstanding work, Okenwa Nguma, in police reform. But the portrait that you have given us of the scale of criminality in which the Nigerian police is implicated is so egregious and shocking that I'm wondering if there is actually an argument to be made for reform, or if the police in Nigeria should just be absolutely gutted, okay? Just that there should be an absolute destruction of what passes for police and policing in Nigeria, so that a new organism, a new entity, a new vision would then slowly emerge to take its place. I know that at some point we're going to talk about the decentralization of policing, state police, community policing, and so on, has happened in other countries. But I just want you to, given what your vantage point, you have seen so much, I'm sure you've documented so much, right? Given what you've seen, do you even believe that it is possible to reform this entire mess? Or should we just throw away the whole thing, the whole edifice, wreck it, bring a wrecking ball to it, and then restart a different way?
Yes, this is not a new question. You know, for me, I've always I've been in a forum where someone actually met the radical. Took the radical position that the entire Nigerian police force should be disbanded and then a new set recruited. But the question then is, how do you go, in practice, how do you go about doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I think that question is warranted because the enormity of the crimes that we see, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes a lot of my colleagues have, out of frustration, have decided to go away from this business of police reform. I mean, business in quote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It can be frustrating. I really don't know how that can happen to abolish the police and start afresh. So what would take, is that going to be a transitional thing? How would that happen? But I think that bad as it is, it would have been worse if not for the consistent advocacy that some of us have been, you know, undertaking. I think that my answer to that would be that you can't have the police you deserve in any, you desire in any country if you don't have the government that you desire. And I think that police reform is an integral part of political reform. If we want to have the police we deserve in this country. I think we need to change the nature of politics in this country. Politics is like is politics in Nigeria is like a criminal enterprise, you know.
It is.
Yeah. So, and because it is the character of the police is shaped by the character of the state, of the government. So we can only continue to advocate, you know, hoping that we can minimize, you know, the atrocities until we have the government that will really represent the will of the people, that really represents a government in a democracy. And until that happens, it will be difficult to have the police you can call a democratic police mm-hmm. that will be accountable to the people and not to the people in authority. And it is because they are accountable to the people in authority that is why they can do what they are doing mm-hmm. and be able to get away with it. So I'm simply saying that to achieve far-reaching police reform, we must achieve political reform, which means changing the system of things in such a way that the people will be able to determine the outcome of elections, and that those who emerge as political leaders are people who come out of the mandate of the people, mm-hmm. who are accountable to the people. So without political reform, we can't have, you know, any meaningful police reform.
Okay. Emeka, I crave your indulgence to sneak in another question that I had just alluded to, which has to do with the entire debate in Nigeria over the establishment of state police and perhaps even community level local government police. Where do you fall on that? Do you see any prospects for greater transparency and accountability, or do you think that is simply going to, as it were, localize and multiply the areas of crisis and criminality, and so on?
So in Nigeria, we are running federalism. Mm-hmm. Now, in a true federalism, what you find is decentralization of, mm-hmm. you know, government structures. So now one of the banes, so ordinarily, logically then, you expect that the police should be structured to fit into the federal system, which means you have police at the federal level, you have police at the other levels, the federating entities. That would be the ideal thing. So, in other words, decentralizing policing in Nigeria. And it is agreed that one of the key obstacles to police effectiveness is its over-centralized structure. So, based on that, a lot of people have argued that the police needs to be decentralized. And for many, decentralization means a lot. Some see it in terms of allowing states to have their own police, including, of course, when we talk about community policing, it's another word for democratic policing. Ordinarily, the police should be, policing is local, mm-hmm. you know. So, but when we talk about state police, it's allowing states, we are the federating units, to have their own police. Mm-hmm. Just as in Nigeria, we have the independent National Electoral Commission having also their state components, you know, state electoral commissions, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, you know, the high court, federal high court, you know, state high courts. But the problem people have is that with the character of our politics and the way, you know, governors are emerge in this country. Governors mm. in Nigeria are more like emperors who own the states. And when you see what they have done with the police, which is not even, you know, their state police, the federal police, but their relationship with the commissions of police, how they use them to target their political opponents, to, you know, to intimidate, to attack. People are afraid to allow them, you know, to set up state police. If you even look at some states where they have set up law enforcement entities that are state controlled, and what they have used them to do.
Militia, the kind of militia, as it were.
So a lot of people are afraid to allow that to happen. For me, you know, I think that at the level we are, the decentralization I want to see is, you know, devolving policing powers and resources to lower structures. For example, you have the force headquarters, you have the zonal commands, you have the state commands, you have the divisions. At the moment, all the decisions are made from top,
and there,
including budgets. Budgets. The police budgeting is top bottom rather than bottom top. So they don't take into account the needs of the lower levels. So if it is possible to have that form of decentralization such that the commissioner of police should be able to take certain decisions without having to refer to Abuja. The constitution even says that a commissioner, a governor can give directives to the commissioner of police, but the commissioner of police may decide to refer to the inspector general of police before he complies. So that tells you the level of centralization.
Yes.
So that for me is the level that I would, you know, support. I would not support allowing state governors, if you allow a governor like Kopos or Demba to imagine what he would do with state police.
Yes. Okay. So please, Emeka, jump in.
I was looking at, I was looking at your bio. You went to UNN. My father went to UNN as well. He did biz admin. He did finish back in, eventually finished right after the Civil War in 71. So, and also you did philosophy, which apparently Peter Obi also did philosophy. So I don't know if you guys came across yourselves by any chance.
No, okay, he's a much younger man.
This one that you guys seem to have such a serious passion for Nigeria as well. It's very interesting. But I mean, on a distance from that, it's just a question of how did you decide to, what made you get into advocacy for police reform primarily as, I don't know if, I believe that's your primary thing that you take part in. So what made you get into it? I also get that it affects all of us. I can give you my own stories. Yeah, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I have numerous stories. I'm an older millennial, so I have plenty of stories. I can fill up a book with it. So I get that part, but just generally, what made you take it up as more or less at this point, even a career?
Okay, so I graduated from UNN in 1992. So as an undergraduate, I was actively involved in student unionism in the University of Nigeria. That was the era when students' unionism was unionism indeed, you know, when the authorities, university authorities, were afraid of the students' unions. In those days of NANCE was involved in not just national but international affairs. You know, if NANCE coughed then, the whole country would catch cold. Today, things have deteriorated. So we are exposed to a lot of, you know, political education, because we had lecturers in those days who were truly patriots, you know, who found the need to groom students to become patriots, and so it was that I was exposed to a lot of political ideologies as a student undergraduate. I was a member of the Marxist Youth Movement and all those kinds of, you know, movements in university. the students' union then were controlled by political movements. Not today that student cultists are now in charge of our students' unions. You see them driving, they collect money from politicians and riding exotic cars with their plate numbers written Nance One, that is the president. In those days, you dare not. In those days, we had no business with politicians. We were giving bribe when we were organizing protests, and we rejected bribe. Mm. You know, so that was the background I came from. I came from a radical background, you know, student unionism. So when I graduated, that was in, it was still under it was during the military era. That was the time Babangida had annulled June 12th, and then Abacha took over and all that. So the Civil Liberties Organization was formed to, you know, to fight military rule, you know. So a lot of us upon graduation found CLO the next port of calls. Yeah, I don't know whether you know the likes of Imez Azo, you know, Chim Obani,
Clem Nwankwo.
Of course, they were the founders. Alois Abakoba and Clement Nwankwo, they were the founders. But of course, radical students, activists took over, you know, CLO and made it a real movement that it was, which was why it was prominent in the days of anti-military, you know. So that was the background I came from. And from CLO, when I joined CLO, I found myself working in a project called Police Research Project. Mm-hmm. So that was how my initiation into police reform, you know, happened. And all through my life, I've always been monitoring, documenting human rights violation by police and other law enforcement agents. Mm-hmm.
I believe, what was her name, used to be part of, I don't know if she still is, Joelle
Odumake.
Odumake.
Yeah.
Yeah, Odumake was in the Campaign for Democracy, which again was fostered by the Civil Liberties Organization as mm-hmm. as the political wing of the Civil Liberties, you know, movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you go in deeply with CLO and... Well, I mean, CLO, you've had a level of political education, let's put it that way, and it enlightened you to a point where you felt that you needed to take up a torch in that era. From what you're saying, in that era, the type of structure was more beholden to the people than it was to any politicians or interest groups. It didn't matter your ideology. So whether you were a Marxist, whether you were a socialist, whether you were an unbridled capitalist, there was a level of populism. You were all fighting for people to be able to live their lives to the fullest, you know, as they'll say in the West, which can sometimes be very weird, this thing. But overall, I would say, I would ask, like, for you, if you're taking a look at, especially from 92, where there was military rule and this thing, do you feel like you touched on it, I believe, kind of, but do you take a look at it? And me personally, I used to complain when Obasanjo came into power. I was the biggest fan of democracy at that point in time. I was just coming out of secondary school when they were coming out, so I wasn't able to vote. So I was the biggest fan of Obasanjo, this thing. I felt Amnesty International. I felt all those credentials. I felt all those things. And they come into power, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, yeah, they should adopt. At that point in time, my thinking was that they should keep adopting the states, which they did, and create this semblance of American democracy, and everything would work. So I got to a point in time where I kept complaining, and obviously if you complain that much, you become a broken record, whether you like it, whether you realize it or not. I became a broken record at a point in time, and my cousin looked at me one day and told me, if people get the leader they deserve. All right, so for you, don't you feel at this point in time the Nigerian police system, the Nigerian police culture, the NSAS. And I feel NSAS was a beautiful moment because I feel it was a beautiful moment where people put their ideologies aside. It didn't even exist. People came together for the common good. It wasn't my ethnic group is supreme to yours, which is typically the case in Nigeria. But ever since then, it's reverted even worse. Like it took one step forward. And for me, it's taken 90 steps backwards since then. Nigeria is more divided than in my life I've known. And as somebody who has and keeps studying history and philosophy, it's way more divided to me. Although there's an argument, there's a debate that there are times that it was more, you know, 64, especially people talk about that, but that's not the debate here. But don't you feel that Nigeria has not just the leader they deserve, but by extension, the kind of civil society and especially law enforcement and community relations that it has fostered and wants and continues to foster and impedes? Nigeria in itself is impeding itself from progressing to a more wholesome society. What do you feel about that?
Well, sometimes there is a temptation to blame the victim. You know, Nigerians have been known historically to be people who are able to stand up against, you know, oppression. Nigerians fought the colonial masters to a standstill. Nigerians fought the military to a standstill. In 2012, Nigerians rose against removal of subsidy under Jonathan. But of course, you know, over time, the Nigerian ruling class have perfected strategies to keep Nigerians down. And I think they do this. One of their strategies is poverty. When they impoverishment, you know, they have so much impoverished Nigerians that sometimes, and I mean, the democratic culture has also, you know, there's a deliberate strategy to destroy the democratic culture in Nigeria. Like in those days I was talking about, you had NAMS, ASSO, Nigerian Medical Association, Nigerian Bar Association, working collaboratively, you know, to resist. But today, these different organizations, they have been destroyed. So there is no rallying point. There is no
co-opted in a lot of ways. Co-opted,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, look at under the present government, a lot of people who supported the shenanigan that went on in the campaigns, were people who used to be former, you know, activists, you know, to those even in the media, those who held their own, who stood their ground fighting the military. Today they have become apologists. Mm-hmm. So the ruling class is doing much to co-opt, you know, to destroy these, you know, movements and to impoverish Nigerians, you know. So there is no more rallying point. But I think that these things don't last. I'm sure that with time, something will snap and you see that Nigerians will rise again. I do not think that we need to blame Nigerians. It's because there is no leadership to galvanize Nigerians. And the ruling class are doing their best to make sure that they deny Nigerians that leadership that they need to mobilize them and to galvanize them to action. But it will happen, you know, someday.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting, so if you go into African philosophical thought, especially like if you're being Igbo or this, then Nigerian construct is something that is antithetical to Igbo philosophical organization just inherently, in any way, shape or form, an egalitarian society and all that. It's very antithetical. And again, for those that are listening, always as when Igbo say, well, we've always had elections, for instance, as an example of egalitarian societies. For those that listening should also understand that that doesn't necessarily equates anybody being better than the next person. It's just something that's antithetical to, and it's all over history. If you go anywhere, some people are like this, other people are like that. So that's something that, and with a lot of ethnic groups like that, TV people are also egalitarian, to name a few. But it goes back to, if you go into some very pertinent philosophies, surely like Western philosophy, where Socrates and Plato talk about, they themselves are anti-direct democracy. And they're anti-direct democracy, alluding to what you're saying in terms of people, it's not that people shouldn't vote, it's that they feel like voting, just exactly what you're doing, being is an actor in the civil space, requires a certain amount of interest, education, and not education in the sense of today's labeling reality. Even doesn't matter where you are, whether you're in Nigeria, wherever, education largely, I'm not saying everybody, but largely is a label industry. It's about distributing labels. You have arguments. I had a conversation with somebody yesterday that went to school in Europe, and everything, just every next sentence is, This, you know, I went to school here, I did this, I did that, but no substance, right? But in terms of what they were saying, which I think is very pertinent to them and very pertinent to Nigeria specifically, is that people need a certain level of involvement, education, you putting everything in it, which people, well, putting everything into it, which people don't typically do in direct democracies. Understanding, and it's not about taking away your biases or your interest. If you say you want your people to be great, or you, whichever people you are talking about, whether it's socially or ethnically or this thing, it's also to be aware of the society you're in and how they can be great within that context, right? But people typically don't get involved in that. It's a lot easier. Doesn't matter where you are in the West, in Nigeria, but in the case of Nigeria, you have an even less involved or a less informed. Not people like you that are very informed. If you, the A to Z of police brutality in Nigeria, I'm sure you have like stacks and stacks of books you can sit down and you know, people are not that informed. People simply don't even care. You see every once in a while. And that's the bleed off to democracy, like in Nigeria. Is it, you know, you talked about people snapping. Do you feel that's going to happen? Do you hope when it happens that there would be a wholesale reform? I can see you're anti, like somebody like me, for instance, I'm pro guns. My father taught me that, and that logic has always stayed with me. Like, you have a gun, I have a gun. There should be state police. State police has a gun, I got a gun. But you're like, no, this guy's going to use it for that. And I'm like, I understand you. I agree with your point of view. If that kind of policy implemented in that kind of way is going to create chaos, right? But for me, I believe that it should be implemented in the case of guns. I checked a tyrannical government. And I'm saying all this to say, what kind of, do you ever envision some kind of, because it needs, at this point in time, and if you go into history as well, but at this point in time in Nigeria, Nigeria needs not just a snap that will change things on the margins, at the edges, but a snap that actually like really changes things, because we keep getting worse and worse. It's like we take, okay, NSAS is not there, but I'm watching today, Nigerian police is doing this, driving over. And it's not now that they're just doing it anymore. It's that people are, just like you said, are defending them publicly. People that you would brandish all kinds of credentials. So it's gotten worse than even 4 years ago, in my opinion. Because before, at least 4 years ago, if something happened, there were people that even the most ardent people would be like, well, this shouldn't happen. But now they're defending it. They're like, no, this is not what, you know. So I, my thing to you is, do you ever feel that Nigeria will get to that point where it snaps and there's meaningful reform inside that society. Do you ever think that would happen? Or would it be a snap and then what they call Hope Uzodinma becomes the chairman of the Imo State Police Association and he takes us 10 steps backwards? You know, and I would agree. Again, I agree with you. Like, if that happened, like, I'm apprehensive of going to Nigeria right now. And just imagine if you have that kind of scenario. I mean, a lot of people overseas, we sit down and we're like, look, it's come to the point where when people die now, Charlie, as an Igbo person, five, six years ago, you died, even people will still be making an argument that they should carry that corpse to Nigeria. But now the argument, and I've been part of peripherally for multiple people who have died, and nobody, the arguments are not even serious anymore. People are just like, look, man, just bury the person here. It doesn't matter. It's a dead body. The guy is wherever, or the lady is wherever she is, right? So people are giving up on Nigeria in terms of like anything would happen. It bleeds into everything I'm saying. Like the population is seems just to go along with it. It feels like even if there is a change, what kind of change are we expecting? Are we expecting what we are seeing, where people are having a change and they are suffering and they are defending what would seem to have been the indefensible 20 years ago, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago? It just progressively gets worse. So for you, now how do you see it? Do you ever feel like, is it a hopeless fight? That's the overall question. Is it a hopeless fight, or is it a fight that you feel that no matter what it is, there's always going to be, that Nigeria, or the space called Nigeria, would at some point in time get to a point where people would look back and not believe that, you know, these things happen at a point in time? So what do you feel like? What is it? Is your struggle born out of survival, or is it born out of not just survival, but, you know, a shining castle on the sea, at a guy on the hill at some point in time?
Well, you know, we've come to situation in Nigeria where, unfortunately, a lot of people now have given up and depend, not rely on God for salvation. In those days, we used to say that when your oppressor, when the people are oppressed and are pressed to the wall, that there are two options left for you: either to pick up the gauntlets and fight your oppressor, or you stay back on the wall and continue to pray to God to soften the heart of your aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that somebody has said that Nigerians would rather break the wall rather than, you know, face the aggressor. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's a combination of many factors, and you've hinted to, some of them. The deliberate destruction of education in Nigeria, is part of the strategies, you know, because you see, when the people are not informed, when the people are not educated, they don't know their rights, they don't know what to do, how to respond to situations. So you rightly said that under the immediate past government, Nigeria became more divided than ever. And I think it was also part of the strategy, you know, so that Nigerians are made to look at themselves from their various ethnic groups. You know, they like to pit Nigerians against one another along ethnic and religious lines. So I already talked about the absence of, you know, a movement that can, you know, rally Nigerians around their common enemies, you know. In those days, when I was growing up, I used to have stories about people who were involved in the anti-colonial, you know, struggle. We could talk, refer back to people who were actively involved in the fight against military rule. All these people have gone. The few that are alive are no longer, you know, strong enough to do anything. Now, we didn't, there was no deliberate effort to breed the younger generation that will take over the fight. So you find a situation where there are no forces that are well-informed, educated, and, you know, committed to the struggle of, you know, defending and deepening democracy in Nigeria. That, I think, is the challenge that we face. But of course, things don't just happen. Change, you know, doesn't just happen. It's a product of an organized, you know, struggle. But the challenge is who is organizing Nigerians? Who are the people to lead this struggle that people have led in the past? I think we can, the least option that we have is to give up. I don't think we can give up because sometimes circumstances can come up that will provide that trigger. For now, if you ask me, I don't know where the solution will come from. But I think that society is dynamic. Something will happen one day, and before you know it, some change happens, you know. For now, it's difficult for me to really, really handpick, you know, I mean, pinpoint to the source of the solution. There are no organizations that you can rely on to say this is the organization as we used to have in the past. We used to have the Campaign for Democracy. We used to have the United Action for Democracy. No such organizations exist anymore. The Gade for Obedience are all gone. The Team Obedience are all gone. Femi Falana is getting old. He's just like a low voice in the wilderness. And I don't know if he's able to mobilize and come to the street anymore. But I think that situations can compel people to act in one way or the other. So I do hope that one day, you know, these things will keep happening. It may come in form of sudden, you know, just like we have had in some African countries, where suddenly you find that people suddenly found their voice and they rose up and something happened.
In a lot of ways, that's what happened with the NSAS movement. There was no planning. Yeah. Nobody saw that this was in the offing. It's just there was some combustion and young people began to, so there was this element of spontaneity. By the way, I don't know how much time do you have, because that will sort of shape where the conversation goes. How much time do you think you still have left? We've done about an hour and 10 minutes.
If we can conclude in the next 20 minutes, okay. I'll be happy.
Okay. So let me get to, Emeka, with your permission, let me get to some of the, you know, sort of questions that I guess we lose sight of in Nigeria. So we talked about the Okozo SARS, which was particularly notorious for the egregiousness of the crimes that were committed there by police officers, you know, unspeakable crimes. And one of those, perhaps the leader of that group was, I believe, a police officer named James Nwafor, right?
Yes.
Who I think is no longer a serving police officer. Is there any movement in the direction of holding him accountable for the alleged crimes that he committed there? And you also spoke about Abakari. What is the state of the... I know that there was a request for him to be extradited to the United States. So do you have any insight on what's happening in those, say, two cases at least that you could share?
Okay, so in the case of James Nwafor, I got involved in a lot of cases that, you know, involved him, where he killed people, you know, he killed a lot of people. This man was very bloodthirsty. You know, he could pick his pistol and shoot anybody at, you know, just as his mood, you know, mood swing, you know. So, on account of several petitions against the atrocities he committed, he was, many petitions that came to the Anambra State Judicial Panel, including petitions that came up in Abuja, his name came up. But he never responded to any of the summons.
And really?
This speaks to the level of, you know, impunity. Impunity, you know. He never came up. He never responded. And nothing happened. Now, when Solomon Arese, who is currently the chairman of the Police Service Commission, was, when he was the Inspector General of Police, he had set up an investigation team to investigate many petitions against James Wife. That petition, that team was set up at the Zone 2 in Lagos. Zone 2 is the zonal command. You have Lagos and Ogun are under Zone 2.
Mm-hmm.
So he set up a team of investigators. We invited him several times.
James Wafo.
James Wafo refused to turn up. I remember that when he retired from the police, he found himself back to government. The then Anambra State governor, the one before the current governor,
Obiano,
appointed him one of his security aides. And I think that was an attempt to, you know, shield himself, you know. So what I'm simply saying is that...
But he was dismissed after some hue and cry, wasn't he?
I think that what happened was that... Yes, what happened was that he was removed from Okoso. He was moved at OCSAS or Okoso and transferred to Imo State. He was rejected. He was transferred to Ada Edo. He was rejected. He kept moving from one place to another until I think he actually reached his
retirement
age in service. I'm not sure. I don't think he was dismissed. From the information I have, because I know he kept moving from one state to another, and they kept rejecting him until he retired and Obiano appointed him. And this was contrary to public outcry, you know. And that was why he refused to honor summons to appear before tribunals of inquiry. And the fact that he could not be arrested tells you the story about who he was, who he was representing. Because today the story is told that these officers that are accused of involvement in organ harvesting work with some very influential people. So that is why they seem to be untouchable. So why he has not been arrested is what I cannot say. But I'm aware that he has been invited, he has been summoned. Nobody knows where he is now. With regards to Abba Kyari, you know that Abba Kyari was OCSAS in Lagos, where he also was involved in a lot of atrocities. Solomon Arase had to remove him and created the intelligence response team. He was the first commander of that team. And I'm aware that Arase had to create that team because he needed to remove him from Lagos. His previous attempt to remove him was resisted by the upper of Lagos and the then governor of Lagos State. He had to create that unit to persuaded him to go over to this unit. That was how he created that unit, where he was committing the atrocities. The Nigerian police have done their best to shield him. Of course, you know the reason he's still in prison is because of indictments on crime, on drug, crimes brought against him by the National Drug Law Enforcement Agency. A lot of people have suggested that this was part of the strategies to keep him away from being taken by the U.S. I don't know whether that is true. That could be speculation. But I know that as long as someone is facing investigation in Nigeria, for example, the U.S. may have to wait for him to, you know, to answer to that and there. But I don't think that the U.S. Nigeria may continue to shield him, but it can only be for so long. Mm-hmm. One day, America will get him. But what surprises me is that, just like I said from the beginning, this man had been committing atrocities.
And your organization, amongst others, documented those.
We are documenting and exposing them.
So when you documented this, because I wanted to speak to the role of the media, okay, so we of course know about the role of the political hierarchy, which often uses the police and are invested in corruption in the police because they use the police for elections, they use the police to intimidate their political opponents and so on. So the political class has no interest so much in police accountability. But I want you, so when you would document crimes by errant rogue police officers, how did your documentation, how did it travel? How did you track them? In addition to perhaps offering them to the police hierarchy, the IG of police and the disciplinary, maybe the police service commission, maybe to the presidency, where else did you send your documents and how did the Nigerian media rise to the occasion in pursuing these cases or not?
So we document these cases and we wrote several petitions mm-hmm. based on specific cases to the Inspector General of Police, to the Police Service Commission, which is the oversight agency that, you know, is responsible for police external oversight.
Mm-hmm.
We had, in fact, when the House of Representatives, the National Assembly,
mm-hmm.
invited Abakiri to the parliament and stood up to him and gave him an award for being a super cop.
Mm-hmm.
We also wrote and, you know, presented all the evidence of the atrocities we had documented in the past. Now, the super cop, you know, was a media creation. Papa Kiari had some journalists in Nigeria in his payroll who were burnishing his image, who were writing, you know, trying to, you know, write good reports about him, present him in the image of a mm-hmm. super cop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why when this thing happened, when America came for him, a lot of us said that we always do this man as a super criminal, not a super cop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we wrote to the police authorities, we wrote to the Police Service Commission, we also wrote to the National Assembly, which also has oversight powers over the police, but they ignored all this. Of course, there were a lot of reports in the media about some of these atrocities, but of course, they made no meaning to those who continued to shield him because mm-hmm. they were actually preparing him to become the next Inspector General of Police. And if America had not intervened, I can assure you today, he probably would have become the Inspector General of Police. That is the tragedy of... Mm.
I would like to know, now you talked about that preparation and all that, you have two figures in Nigerian police as of today. The current IG, which I can't remember his name, and Nuhu Ribadu. What's your take on, well, Nuhu Ribadu is NSA, but what's your take on these two individuals specifically? And, well, actually, even though he's, I think at this point in time, any reasonable person would say he's mute. The head of the EFCC, I think, is just a political witch hunter arm at this point. I mean, unless that person just wants to be a mischievous person, which there are a lot of them out there. Can go on YouTube and check out Nigerian media personalities still talking about EFCC as a serious thing. But what's your take on those three individuals heading these three places right now? Even though two of them are on acting capacity, But what's your take on them in terms of their careers and the police and their careers in law enforcement and what you guys might have on them?
So you've talked about Nuhu Ribadu, right?
Nuhu Ribadu, one of them, yes.
Nuhu Ribadu, the IG of police and the head of the EFCC.
The head of the EFCC, I don't know whether that has been the former commissioner of police in Lagos. I don't know whether that has been confirmed yet.
There's somebody on acting capacity right now. They removed Magu. I think Magu, what was it?
No, they're Bauer.
Bauer. Yes, Bauer. They removed Bauer. They've brought in some guy, one of their people.
He used to be the commissioner of police in Lagos, right?
Yeah. When I say their people broadly, the Nigeria is more of a criminal organization. So let me get the guy's name. They brought in.
I'm trying to remember his name now as well. You know, but of course, you know there were controversies over his appointment. You know, at one point they said it was him. At another point they said it was rumor. So I haven't made sure that.
There's a guy called Hakim Odumosu.
Odumosu, yes, he was a former CP in Lagos. I'm not sure that he has been announced. Has he been announced?
He's been announced as executive chairman acting, former CP. Then he was promoted to IG. Then as on his retirement, something like that.
AIG, rather. Well, let me start from him. He was the CP in Lagos before he became AIG and then retired. As CP in Lagos, his term was this man, you know, in terms of human rights. He was one of the commissioners of police that would issue threats or directives.
So just to update more, there was some dispute on it, but apparently I think you are right. There's some dispute on it, but people are listing him as being, I don't know, these guys.
His name came up on social media, but I know that it was disputed. That's why I'm saying unless that happened, I'm not aware. But it will be a tragedy if the man becomes the chairman of the year, because he had a dismal record. He was one of the commissioners who would easily issue directives banning protests in Lagos when he was commissioner of police. If you mention human rights, he has contempt for human rights and human rights advocates. So that one is for me, you know, it will, I don't know why it is. But for this, the new IGP, I didn't really have much contact with him. I do not have a lot of information about him. I've also tried to do a check and I didn't find so much about him. So my only concern is that his appointment again
seems irregular.
We thought that President Bola Tinubu will move away from the practice by the former president where he will simply, you know, handpick and appoint whoever he likes without reference to the law. That's what has happened in this case. There was no consultation with the police council. He was not the most qualified in terms of whether it's qualification or seniority.
Experience,
you know. Well, Nuhu Ribadu, you know, at the international level, he seems to enjoy a lot of goodwill. He's been hailed as a champion of anti-corruption. But what can I say? One of the things that comes to my mind each time I remember Nuhu Ribadu was that he was the one that arrested a one-time Inspector General of Police for corruption.
Tafa Balogun.
And make sure he was dragged, you know, physically dragged and bundled, you know, arrested. But of course, when he was promoted, there were also protests. You know, I think people said he got irregularly promoted. I think it was the president then, President Jonathan. Was it Jonathan?
I made him an AIG.
Yeah, made him an AIG, and he was protested. You know, but I mean, he's been. People say he was the best. Of course, you know, he was the pioneer chairman of EFCC.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that anyone has any chairman of EFCC after him has achieved better result than he did. But I don't know.
But he seems to have, in some ways, in some ways, he seems to have repudiated his own, yeah. A lot of things he said, he has gone back on them. I mean, one example is that floats around now, and he consistently talked about the six most corrupt governors in Nigeria, and six of them are all running things now. You're talking of George Akume, you're talking of Bola Tinubu, you know, they're all running things, and you know, he's serving at their behest as the national security advisor. So sometimes I sit down when I see that, and I remember it vividly. I wonder if this guy is just sitting down there and maybe being some kind of a double agent of some sort. Like, it's just that I can't reconcile it personally. I just like, wow, maybe this guy's hoping like you that one day somebody would come in and cares about these things, and then he will have the files on all these people and be like, yeah, you know, I serve these people. I'm going to come out and testify against them. If not, this guy has done a complete 360, 180. Like, he's no longer that guy. Completely,
he's not a politician, and I think there's a reason why Bola Tinubu chose him as his. I suspect it was a payback time for shielding him, because under Nuhu Ribadu, a lot of people called for Tinubu's arrest for corruption and all manner of things. But so I think they have something together that we don't know. So it's payback time for him, for not prosecuting him.
So we're sort of inching toward the 20-minute mark that you said you had, and I wanted to sort of as a form of doing house cleaning. If you were asked to propose, it's a number of steps, of measures that would help to orient the police in the proper direction of being accountable, being a people's police force, being a police force that is that owes allegiance to the people, not to the political flavor of the day, the political presidency. What are some of the steps that you would recommend? And there was a different question that I also wanted to ask, that in Nigeria, the police often serve as private security units. Police are farmed out to well-to-do Nigerians, and a lot of them have come by their means, by their wealth, through criminal means, at least means that are not altogether licit. And some of those police operate recklessly. They will hit people's cars and in the convoy of the rich and so on, and just beat up the victims. So if you can talk about that for a little bit, what that means, that the private individuals are now giving the police, instead of the police securing the social space, that they secure just privileged individuals, but also to speak about some of the steps that you think are important if we're going to have the police that we desire.
So you find that there's what they call privatization of security in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Where police officers in a country where we don't have the numbers, the required number of personnel to serve and protect the population.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals are able to pay to get police officers assigned to them. And this is not just an abuse of the police, but they also use these police officers to abuse
citizens.
I'm sure you are aware of the case of this musician who had four police officers attached to him, and he went to a nightclub, was harassing a woman who was with her husband, and when the husband challenged him, they fired up and shot at somebody, you know, and nothing happened. What's the name of this this Nigerian musician? You know, such things happen. Bonaboy, I don't know whether you had that story.
Oh my gosh, no, I didn't.
Bonaboy, yeah, he had four police officers who went to a nightclub and was harassing a woman who was actually with the husband. And when the husband questioned him, the police officers, you know, shot in the air, injuring somebody. And the next day, he entered the plane and left Nigeria. You know, it happens every now and then. It's part of the evidence that we have to show that the police is not a police of the people. It's a police of the ruling class, you know. They are set up to serve the privileged and then to oppress the ordinary people, you know. But of course, it also speaks to the fact that the police is under the control of politicians, which is the point I made about the need to insulate the police from political control. That, for me, is the starting point. Mm-hmm. And that's also the point about having the government that we deserve, you know, or we desire, you know, rather. Unless we reform our political system to, you know, serve the people, we can't have the police we desire, because the government still controls both the appointment process, the, you know, everything about, you know, whether it is you know, postings, recruitment. Even ordinary recruitment. The procedure for recruitment is circumvented. Senators will send lists, and these are lists of their thoughts, and they are recruited into the police. They don't, some of them, a lot of, there's an established guideline for recruitment, which stipulates, you know, in terms of background checks, minimum educational qualification, and all that, physical fitness, psychological, you know, stability and all that. These things are not done. Politicians will send lists, the governors will send lists, senators will send lists, and these are lists of people who don't have the minimum qualification, but because they're coming from politicians, they enroll them into the police. So these are the people that they use during elections. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so for me, insulating the police from political control, professionalizing the police, making it, you know, a police that is accountable to the law and to the people, not just to the political elites. If we don't achieve that, every other thing will not fall in line. If you talk about training does not make sense when you recruit untrainable people. Many of them don't have the minimum qualification. They cannot write or read. So when you're training them, what are you training? You give them arming criminals.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, so for me, this is the foundation. Depoliticize, democratize the police. You know, good governance. Without good governance, we can't have any and nothing can work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. We can talk about training, talk about equipment, talk about welfare, but all these are after we have laid the background, where we now have a police that we can call a police of the people, a police of democracy.